Welcome to the Villa Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it's 3:49, 7 p.m. and that is Central Time. And today is September 21st. Well, there's a couple of things I'd like to focus on today. The first is that Wall Street is pulling back in the aftermath of the Federal Reserve meeting yesterday, and bond yields and the long end are rising and rising quite a bit faster than the short end of the curve. So that means that the yield curve spread is starting to push back up again. And then oil prices were quite steady today, but just about everything else sold off. Then I think we'll look a little bit at Japan for a couple of different reasons. The first being that dividend growth there is picking up, and that is and dividend growth is something that I'll definitely think touch more on, but I think it's important to highlight it as being one of the primary defenses against inflationary trends, in that if a company can raise its dividend faster than the interest rate is going up, then as an investor, you're being adequately compensated in terms of the income that you receive from the dividend versus what is then the competing force from the central bank. And then, of course, you have the potential for capital appreciation if the business is still performing. And one would assume that it is still performing if they're able to continue to raise dividends at a competitive rate. But then the outlook for the yen and what happens in terms of the central bank action in Japan probably has much wider ramifications generally. So that's something we should think about as well. Then let's also look at a couple of the currency market charts in addition to the yen, and we'll think about how that is going to impact that both the dollar rally and then also the outlook for other currencies and gold as we start to see that interest rates do eventually peak, and gold has been performing more like a currency recently, in that it's been fairly steady against the US dollar, but hasn't been rallying despite, and that has been a capping factor because the dollar has been quite firm. Then against the euro and the pound, it has been quite firm. Against the Australian dollar, the gold price is practically at a new high. And then against the Japanese yen, it's even stronger again because the yen has been among the weakest currencies. And of course, then in rupees, where the rupee has broken down to a new low, that's also been beneficial for gold. Now, gold is a monetary metal, and the times when it does best are when it's appreciating in every currency. So we're not quite there yet, but certainly central bank action to buy gold, particularly in the emerging markets or in those countries that are less friendly to the USA and NATO more generally, that's certainly also been a mitigating factor that has helped to support the gold price. So there's certainly plenty to think about in here today. And I think we should just crack on then and think about what's happening in terms of this yield curve spread. The point that I've been making for most of the last year is that there are three phases to an inverted yield curve. At the initial inversion, people panic and they wonder that they then start to panic that there's going to be a recession. And they're right, there will be a recession, but there are long and variable lags and it takes a while. And the most important thing about the yield curve spread is that it's a very long, and it's a very, when we talk about a lead indicator, well, then it really is a very long lead indicator. And the signal can be anything from 6 to 18 months. Then what people start to consider is that, well, maybe things haven't deteriorated as much as we had feared. So the economy is still expanding, and maybe it's a good thing that the central bank is beginning to do something about this inflationary trend. And generally, what happens immediately after the first inversion is that markets begin to recover again. And we get a good-sized rally, and we've seen that on several occasions in the past. The initial inversion was in 2005, and the stock market kept rallying until 2007. And then subsequently, it's the third stage of the inverted yield curve, which really gives it its fame. And it's when the yield curve inversion moves back above zero and trends higher. That's generally when you start to see the real fear of inflation, excuse me, the real fear of recession. And then a panicky action in stock markets, and all of the very bullish prognostications around earnings growth, they start to get pegged back. And I think that's been one of the most profound issues that we've had over the course of the last several months, is that several Wall Street analysts, having been very bearish about the first half of the year, then saw their end year targets taken out practically in March, and they've subsequently been raising their targets and their estimates for what earnings are going to be in 2024 and 2025 and 2026, and of course they're all higher. And that has been one of the primary factors that has helped to support the stock market, this assumption that interest rates can go up indefinitely without having any impact at all on corporate profitability, and that just is unlikely. So at the present moment, what we have is that the 10-year yield is rising faster than the 3-month, and that is helping to contract the inversion. And the 10-year yield marched higher in here, so following through on the upside today. That's a clear dynamic move, closing right on the upper side of the daily range, and testing now the 4.5% level. So that's a clear breakout, and we've seen a quite swift pullback on the S&P 500. So it both gapped down and finished on the low of the day, breaking down to a new reaction low, approaching the region of the 200-day moving average, but we don't have an especially oversold condition. And if this trend up from the lows back in October is going to remain credible, then we're going to have to see support coming through in the region of the 200-day moving average. The last time we had any kind of meaningful consolidation was back in January of this year. So the S&P 500 pulled back from about 4175 down to 3805. So let's just call it about 300 points. And then the peak right now, or most recently, was at 4600, and we're currently at 4300 and change on either side. So it's a relatively equal-sized reaction so far. Now, if the region of the 200-day moving average does not offer support, and that also happens to be the top of the first counter trend rally, well, then the next area of potential support is going to probably be around the 4,000 level as a big psychological level, and by the time it gets there, it'll probably coincide with the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And then I think we're going to have to see what happens after that, because if interest rates eventually do start to come down, then we get the normal path of de-inversion, which is normally that the 3-month of the 2-year starts to come down faster than the 10-year. And I think that we are now starting to see the prospect of the rapid pace of liquidity tightening starting to bite. And this is also particularly relevant for the Nasdaq. The Nasdaq index has been incredibly resilient, but it was also in negative territory today. It has not broken down to a new reaction low yet, so its outperformance is still intact. Now, I've been quite clear in stating that this bull trend is not going to end until the outperformance of the eight largest companies, or the eight large companies, eventually rolls over. And the Fang Man relative to the total market cap index, it is starting to roll over, but it hasn't broken down yet, and it's not below the 200-day moving average either. So the selling pressure is still nowhere near at panic levels. Then let's just go back and look at the performance of the Nasdaq in the last 2 or 3 months of last year. We had a good-sized rebound into August, and then all the way down into the lows in October and through to December. We had weak action. And then let's look at what the yen is doing, or was doing at the time. So the yen devalued all the way through until the low in October, and then staged a really impressive rally. So it was a lot of yen strength corresponded with the bottoming phase in Wall Street. So it's not a one-to-one comparison, but we certainly know that when you have a devaluing currency and zero interest rates, then it becomes a funding mechanism for speculation. And the yen has been especially weak this year, and it is now approaching a potential area of support around the 150 level. Now, there's a great deal of speculation around when is the Bank of Japan going to eventually raise interest rates, and are we approaching that level as the yen comes down and tests that big psychological 150 level? And it's an awfully big question, because the more back history we look at, the more this looks like a completing base formation. And we've had decades over which the yen has traded stronger than 150. And the last time we had a meaningful test of this area was over 20 years ago. And prior to that, it was right at the beginning of the 1990s. So if we see that this first step, and it looks like a first step above the base, if the Bank of Japan does not intervene, then there is the clear possibility that the yen will devalue further. And that will then add a great deal of liquidity and access to funding mechanisms for leveraged trades to the global economy, and or I guess let's not call it the economy, global markets. But I think we do have a short-term oversold condition. There is clearly the potential that the yen could consolidate in this area, and that we might see some weakness in markets first, and then subsequently that would deter any speculation about raising rates. But then we can think about too that the Bank of Japan has basically abandoned its yield curve control program. The 10-year yield is trending higher, and it's up to 75 basis points. So they're not defending the bond yield any longer. And I think that's one of the primary reasons why people are willing to contemplate that perhaps the Bank of Japan is contemplating potentially raising interest rates. Now, if we look at Japan's euro yen futures, and I've gone out to the third month, and that's very slow. Let me see if I can find something that is more liquid. But I think the point is, well, unfortunately, there's none of these are particularly liquid. Well, one thing we can think about is that we don't have a lot of we don't have a lot of speculation right now thinking about when or what if Japan raises interest rates. But the yen carry trade has been accessed by foreign and global investors for a long time. But then the other side of that is that the big pension companies and insurance companies in Japan have been taking their money and investing it abroad. And that has been despite the fact that the yen was strong, because they weren't worried about the strength of the currency so much as being able to capture an asset and capture a competitive yield. And because JGB yields were so low for so long and are only really now starting to break on the upside, then there's clearly scope here that some of the money that's been held overseas is going to start to come back again. And this does look like a very clear break of the trend overall. So when we think about what's likely in Japan, well, there's an awful lot of money that is positioned overseas. And I think it's especially interesting that we're starting to see the insurance companies in Japan, the industrials, really moving to positions of outperformance. So, certainly the industrials and particularly the steel manufacturers are benefiting from the weakness of the currency. But I think we also have to consider that the strength in the industrial sector and the fact that Japan sees an acute need to rearm itself, it basically implies that Japan is rearming without actually saying so. So I think that is a clear trend of direction, and it does suggest that the industrial sector, machinery, and the armaments sector will continue to attract interest. And this whole question around dual use industries is something that is likely to gain a lot more attention from investors and governments, I suspect, over the next several years. When we think about the fact that China now has more ships, now they don't, if you were to measure them in tonnage, then it's not the same thing, but you need an equal number of missiles to destroy a smaller ship relative to a larger ship. And this is one of the bigger calculus points that has come through in terms of the war in Ukraine, that you need the same missile to destroy a 50-year-old tank as you do a 2-year-old tank. And if you have enough tanks, you can run down at the inventory of your adversary. And I think that is the biggest challenge that is arising out of this war in Ukraine, that the inventories are being run down. The one country that has not run down its inventory is China. And that gives it a clear competitive advantage. So I think a lot of countries in the region are going to be in a hurry to both rearm and potentially nuclearize their countries as well. And I think it's only a matter of time before we see countries like South Korea and Japan, or even potentially Taiwan, having some kind of nuclear deterrent, even if they're not willing to talk about and it perhaps adopting the same kind of attitude that Israel has done. Now, as we then think about the broader currency environment, I think the easiest way to do that would be to look at gold. So, gold prices are hovering here around the $1,900 area, but the dollar has been really quite firm. So we have to at least give some credence to the potential that gold prices will go down before they go up. Now, I think that it is quite likely that we're going to see a clear move higher in gold prices when we do eventually see the Federal Reserve cutting interest rates. And when we look at gold in other currencies, well, it gives us a clue as to what we might expect. So the Australian dollar has been quite weak over the last couple of years. And that means that gold prices are right in the region of the upper side of the range. Then when we think about a country which has had a strong currency, like Brazil, then gold has been ranging really for nearly 4 years. So that's considerably longer than we've had elsewhere. Now, the Canadian dollar has been both up and down, so it is at the upper side of the range and holding in the region of the 200-day moving average. Then the euro has been quite weak, so gold broke on the upside in 2022 and has been consolidating there for the last 18 months, so a clear pattern of outperformance relative to the US dollar value. And then the pound has been devaluing more recently. So gold has popped back above the $1,500 area and is above the 200-day moving average again. So what this helps to highlight is gold is being valued more like a currency. And the times when gold does best are when the trend of real rates is going down. Now, that is not the case at present. And I thought it was interesting yesterday that Jay Powell was saying, well, look, we have positive real rates. We've raised rates enough. We've raised to push rates up into positive real levels. So now we're basically waiting and seeing what happens next. But we're probably going to continue to raise rates at a less aggressive pace. But until they stop raising rates, then the most likely scenario is that gold will be lower to lateral ranging. And then when they do start cutting rates, then the trend of real rates will reverse. And as soon as we start to see the Federal Reserve cutting rates, then the dollar will lose its attraction as well. And I think that is the other way of thinking about the outlook for gold, because as soon as investors got the idea that the Bank of England is close to the end of its hiking cycle, well, then the pound has devalued by about 5p, or 5 cents, I should say. So it's a little oversold in the short term, and we might see a little bounce coming through in here because with weaker asset prices overall, investors will start to price in potential that the dollar is going to have a hard time rallying in that environment. So the dollar was not quite able to hold its advance in here today, or all of its advance, and it's looking a little tired after what has been a really impressive rebound over the last 10 weeks. But the mitigating factor has been the continued resilience of the oil price. And Brent crude was down about 30 cents today and was higher in early trading. I do think that we have an overbought condition, so it's quite likely that oil prices are going to come lower from here. But we would need to see a reaction of more than $6 in order to really confirm that the trend higher is inconsistent. We've had a very impressive rebound, and it has broken the medium-term downtrend. So at the bare minimum, this is support building overall, and we could see a lengthy range forming above the $75 level. But or I guess the perhaps more accurately the $60 level. So that would be a meaningful. Excuse me. Let me put this back into local currency terms, and then we'll see the correct levels. I do apologize. So it's around the $75 level, that was my memory kicking in. And now the price right now is at around $93. So we do look like a little overbought. There's obviously the potential for a pause of consolidation. But this has been a meaningful breakout. So if the reaction is just limited to some pause of consolidation, then we have to give the benefit of the doubt to continued upside. Now, the thing that is very much at the back of my mind is what happened in 2006 and 7. We had a strong performance from the banking sector, and the global economy was firing on all cylinders, and the Federal Reserve had been raising interest rates by a quarter of a point for about 2 years, and eventually that started to take a toll. But the defensive sectors and the commodity sectors, they continued higher, even though the banking sector had rolled over. And the banking sector has rolled over on this occasion. The S&P 500 banks were looking barely steady yesterday, and they declined further in here today. And this looks like resistance in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And it's a downtrend overall. And the regional banks, they really don't look attractive. And this is a clear reflection of the tightening bias overall. What I find especially interesting right now is that Amazon is breaking down, and it had a meaningful drop in here today, gapping lower. So that was a very clear downward dynamic. And we've had a very impressive rebound over the last 9 months. And I think now we're definitely getting some consolidation of that move. And if all it is consolidation, then the region of that 1,000-day and 200-day moving average will hold. On the other hand, if we're going to have a much deeper process of consolidation, then it will fail at that level, and we'll see a retest of the 100 level. So we've had these very impressive rebounds, and now we're getting at least consolidation of those moves. Tesla looks at the moment to be putting in a lower rally high, and I think that there's a lot of enthusiasm around the Cybertruck, but we still don't have autonomous vehicles. I was really looking forward to taking a Waymo in San Francisco because they're free to use, or they're not free to use, but one is able to book a ride with Waymo in Phoenix. But they're still in the testing phase, and you have to be invited in San Francisco. That, of course, helps to highlight that it's a lot more difficult to drive on city streets when they're higgledy-piggledy streets. When you're in Chandler, in Phoenix, where there is perfect weather for driving at least, and a complete grid system, then programming a car is a lot easier. So I think we are in a more corrective phase right now, but I think the bigger picture here is that bonds and equity selling off together is not good news. And it's also something that we had a lot of in 2022. So the 60-40 portfolio is also under pressure here and coming back in to test the region of that 200-day moving average. Now, something that I'm particularly paying attention to as a potential indicator of just how deep a correction we might have is at the advanced decline line for the NYSE. So this takes every company that went up and every company that went down on the day, takes the net value and adds it to the index. And this index does not trend downwards unless the secular bull market is over. And the more back history we look at, the greater confirmation we have of that phenomenon. The number of times when this index comes down through the 200-day moving average, but much more the 1,000-day moving average, those are the really significant bear markets. So the more back history we look at, we can very clearly see that every time it has come down below the 200-day moving average has been a deep process of consolidation and have generally been buying opportunities. And then we had a reversion to the 1,000-day moving average in 2022. The last time we saw anything even remotely approaching that was in 2008. And valuations are still exceptionally high. And the advanced decline line has not ramped back up to make a new high. And it is just about holding the region of that 200-day moving average. And if it fails at that area, then I think we need to be very open to the potential that we're going to have a deeper process of consolidation. And I think that this is a particularly important time to have a stop, to think about where your exit strategy is, and if you're amenable to short positions, watch for short-term rallies in order to take out hedged positions. When we think about where the potential risks are, well, I think that there's an enormous amount of money in private credit, and that private credit has been an incredible source of performance over the last decade, and it will continue as long as earnings continue to improve. But if we start to see the economy slowing down and companies unable to make their payments, then the private credit market is going to have a very significant disruptive event. And many of those companies are unlisted. So now the bigger question is going to be, how willing will regulators be to step in and bail them out? I suspect that we will clearly have additional regulation in the aftermath of this recession on the private credit markets. And we will, I think, eventually have a much greater focus on traditional merchant banking. But we're not there yet. And then I think there is obviously the potential that just the slow grind of earnings and not performing, then that will help to initiate additional stimulative measures from the government, from central bankers, but not until we see a deeper process of unwinding of this incredible advance we've had over the last couple of years. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.